All right. We we're looking at Jesus as the Son of God, and looking at his identity as such. We started a couple of weeks ago just looking at this topic of that really focuses on Jesus and his Old Testament identity. In other words, how does the Old Testament, what does it tell us about Jesus, and what, more importantly, did the Old Testament tell Jesus about himself? Okay. And last week we were looking at three Old Testament figures or concepts that Jesus had from Old Testament teachings that really kind of guided him and helped him in not only understanding who he was, but also in his ministry. We talked about the authority or the sovereignty idea that is associated with the Davidic kingship. We talked about obedience, which was the framework of David's throne, was obedience to God. Remember, we talked about how that was the reason that Saul was removed as king, was because of his disobedience. And David's kingdom, his kingship, was grounded in obedience to God. And so Jesus, we saw, grounded in that same concept, as he said, things like that his food that sustained him was to do the will of the Father in heaven. And then we talked about the sacrifice that was linked to Jesus by that very obedience. Again, connected to the Old Testament sacrifice that Abraham made of his son Isaac when he was there on the mountain getting ready to sacrifice his son, and the Lord stopped him. The statement that God had made to him was, "Now I know that you have not withheld your only son from me." And, of course, that is connected to Jesus through at least one statement that John the Baptist made when he saw Jesus and he pointed to him, "Behold, the sacrificial lamb of God's providing, the Lamb of God," which is the same thing that Abraham said to his son Isaac as they were going up the mountain. "We have the fire and we have the wood. Where's the lamb for the sacrifice?" And Abraham's response was, "God will provide the ram for the sacrifice." So we see all of those things that are connected that Jesus was experiencing and identifying with in these Old Testament teachings and examples and so forth. We're looking at all of this kind of based on the statement that was heard not only by Jesus, but by John and by all the other people that were there at Jesus' baptism. When the Holy Spirit descended upon Jesus and the clouds opened and the voice from heaven said, what? "This is my beloved Son in whom I am well pleased." So we're looking at this whole aspect of Jesus as the Son of God. And what did he understand that to mean? And where did he get that concept from? And so forth. Now, last week after our discussion, I had some questions about this whole the whole question and idea of that we wrestle with, you know, this three different or distinct persons in one God, and the part of the question oftentimes seems to be around, well, Jesus was the Son of God, yet he was God, and how does all that work? But another aspect of that is, how much of that at any given time did Jesus really know and understand and so forth? And that's part of what we're looking at. So let's talk for just a minute about this, the whole, you know, three persons in one God and that whole aspect of it and so forth, and see if we can't understand something about that. Let me do that by asking you a question. What do I have in my hand? A what? Yeah, they are. But what kind of piece of fruit is this? it's an apple, right? And you would say, yes, that is an apple. What do I have in my hand? An apple. Okay. If I hold it up like this, what part of the apple do you see? The skin, the peeling, right? Okay. That's the part that typically, if we peel the apple, we just do what with that? We just throw that away, right? Okay. But if I open up the apple and I hold it up like that, what do you see now? You see the seeds. What else do you see? The pulp or the meat. Okay. But what am I holding in my hand? An apple. Do you notice that there are three distinct parts of this apple? There's the outer peeling, there's the meat, and there's the seeds. But I have one apple. And that's what we recognize it as, right? It's an apple. I don't say, well, you got some peeling, and you got some meat there, and then you got some seeds. I say, I've got an apple. Right? Because that's how we recognize it. If you look at the apple and you think about it in terms of spirituality, think about it this way. What does the outside or the peeling do? What's it designed for?
To protect the inside,
right? Okay. What's the meat for? That's the food. That's what we eat, right? You know, that's nourishment there. And what's the seeds for? Future growth, right? Well, isn't that kind of like what we refer to as the Trinity, although that word is not found in the Bible, and that's some people's objection to it. You can't find that phrase, that word, in the Bible anywhere. You can't find the phrase three persons in one God in the Bible anywhere, but you can certainly find the teaching of it throughout the Bible, can't you, that you have God the Father who serves as our protector, and you have Jesus, who is the food or the nourishment. Did he not say, unless you eat my flesh and drink my blood, you have no life in you? And we have the Holy Spirit, who serves as that one who helps us to grow for the future. Does he not? So the idea here is that if we can understand, kindergartner can understand the concept of three parts of an apple, but it's all still only one apple. If we can understand that, then it shouldn't be too difficult for us to understand and to accept, although I cannot understand how it all works any more than I can understand how somebody could plant one of these seeds or a couple of these seeds and it grows out of the ground and it produces this. I don't understand how that happens. I just know that it does. You say, I understand the process behind it, but it's still amazing to me that it, you know, you can take seeds and that's what you get. And how difficult is it for us to accept that we can have three distinct parts of one God, each having their own specific role within the Godhead, just like the three different parts of this apple have their own distinct role. Okay? If we can accept that that's how apples are, then we shouldn't have too much of a difficulty understanding that certainly the Godhead can be the very same way. Three distinct parts of one apple. I mean, God. Okay. Now, we understand that aspect of it, but we still have not answered the question of, okay, we look at all these different things. We look at Jesus, and yes, he's the Son of God. But at any given time, how much did Jesus know and understand about his sonship and what his particular role in, in being part of the apple, so to speak, or the Godhead? How much did Jesus know and understand at any given time in this? Well, the thing that makes it very complicated is, and this is, I think, the part that we oftentimes forget, okay, is the humanity aspect of Jesus. Okay? And someone once put it this way, that perhaps, and again, this is speculation because reality is, I don't know, okay? Perhaps there were things that Jesus chose not to know. I don't know. How much did Jesus know in his humanity about who he was and at any given time in his life and so forth? I don't know. I don't know any more than I know how much any of you know about any particular topic that you know something about. I don't know how much Linda knows about the post office and all the workings. I assume she knows an awful lot about it. She's been working there a long time. But I don't know how much she really knows about it. You see? I don't know how much Wes knows about, you know, Robert's awnings and all the stuff that's going on over there, or how much Chuck knows about concrete and brick masonry. I know he knows a lot about it. I know Wes knows. He's learned a lot about awnings over the last bunch of months. But I don't know how much they know about those things. Okay? There is a certain amount of things that we just have to accept. I believe that Linda knows an awful lot about postal working and, you know, and all the stuff that goes on there, because I know she's worked there for a long time. And so I accept that there are certain things that Linda knows about how that all works. Otherwise, she probably wouldn't be working there anymore. Okay? I just accept that. Call it faith if you want to. I don't know. But I don't know. I don't have that particular knowledge of exactly what she knows in her head. But I know she knows a lot about it. I don't know if that makes any sense or not, but it just has to do with the whole idea that, you know, in our human capacity, there's an awful lot that we just don't know, even about one another and what one another in this room knows. So I don't suppose to be able to figure out and know everything that was in Jesus' head and everything that he knew when he was here. And I think that what that requires then of us is to operate on a certain level of faith. I cannot explain it, but yet I believe it. Okay? I do not know. I cannot explain exactly how, you know, all of that works. This, you know, the whole apple thing and the Godhead. I have a certain limited knowledge about that and understanding. And the rest of it is on faith. But you see, I think what we have to understand is that God does not ask us to have blind faith on these kinds of matters. He gives us enough evidence, you see, that we can understand some things, so that we apply that to our faith and say, I don't understand it all, but I believe that it's so. And so it's not just blind faith where we have nothing to base that faith on. See? And yet at the same time, there are things that we just have to accept that that's what it is, or that we just don't have answers for all of that. How much did Jesus know, and when did he know it? I don't know. But there are certain things that we can understand from the scriptures of what Jesus knew, or at least what he probably would have known based on the scriptures. So let's take a look at some of those things. As we look at Jesus as the Son of God, one of the things that we have to understand about that is that we're trying to identify Jesus, and you know, he's not just, as someone said, he's not just an identikit that's pieced together by bits of Old Testament scriptures. In other words, you know, we look at this passage and this passage. We take all these different passages from the Old Testament, and we're trying to put this puzzle together and see what does Jesus look like. He's a whole lot more, there's a lot more to Jesus than that. We look at it, we need to understand that looking at the Old Testament scriptures and trying to learn more about Jesus is only one side of the equation. Okay? We can certainly do that, but it's not just recognizing Jesus from the Old Testament scriptures, but it's also learning and gaining a new understanding of the Old Testament scriptures in light of Jesus himself. So it's both sides of that particular coin. Does that make sense? See, I want to get to know Jesus. And how can I do that? I can do that by searching the Old Testament scriptures. And in that process, what I'm also doing is by looking at Jesus, I'm gaining a better understanding of those very Old Testament scriptures than I had before. And that's, I think, as it should be. When we look at Jesus and his awareness of God being his Father and he being his Son is perhaps one of the deepest foundations of Jesus' selfhood or his personal identity or understanding of who he was. It all comes back to this whole topic and this issue of this Father-Son identity. When the Father spoke from heaven and said, "This is my Son in whom I am well pleased," what does that really mean? What did it mean to Jesus? And why was it so important that God would make that kind of a statement? You see, I think sometimes we read those passages and we go, "Oh, isn't that cool? God spoke from heaven," and on we go to the next thing, you see. But can we learn some vitally important things, again, not only about Jesus, but about the Old Testament teachings from really looking a little bit more closely at the significance of that statement? Why did God feel it important and significant to make that statement when Jesus was baptized? Is it really an important statement, or was it just something that God figured he'd just throw out there just in case anybody might be wondering what's going on? You see? And I'd suggest to you that there is a whole lot more than that, because the Father and Son were not just teaching, were not just teaching points or even just titles. In other words, I think oftentimes we try to identify, in our study sometimes of the Bible, in particular the Old Testament, we try to identify which God is it that we're talking about simply by these titles. Oh, well, that's the Father. Well, that's the Son, you say. But again, it's much more than just titles. Okay? Those references had to do with identity. And they were an expression of the living reality in Jesus' life that says, the statement basically is about the relationship that he had with God, that only the terms Father and Son could adequately describe. Okay? I think therein is a tremendous amount of significance. Why was it that God would make that kind of a statement at that particular point? When was it? It was the beginning of his ministry, wasn't it? And it was important for Jesus, as well as everybody else that was there, to hear that statement, to be able to know that God, the Father, saw himself in a relationship that was a Father-Son reality. Jesus wasn't just another prophet that came along, as even many claim that he was today. You see? He wasn't just another great teacher, a rabbi that came along to share some new teachings. No, it was significant that the relationship between the Father and the Son be clearly established and identified. Say, so that people understood who he really was. Chuck? Now we're gonna come back to that. No, that's a good question, because again, that kind of a thing goes back to what we were talking about before. How much did Jesus know and how much did he understand about all of those different kinds of things? You know, again, what I want you to think about and focus on is this whole concept of that kind of a statement, Father and Son. What more than anything does that really tell us? It's relationship. That is a statement about relationship. When I say, this is my Son, okay, that speaks of the relationship, doesn't it? You see? And that's what the Father wants to have established, again, not just with the crowd, but also with Jesus. And we talked about last time that Jesus knew and understood and felt firm in that relationship as he's getting ready to go and begin this ministry, as we talked about the week before last. Where did this understanding then, Chuck, where did this understanding come from in terms of this Father and Son relationship? You know, Jesus oftentimes used in his prayers and so forth, he referred to the Father as Abba. Okay? And I'm sure that you have heard that term in different times and so forth. That term is the most intimate Jewish term there is for Father. Okay? So it's not just, you know, an identifying, you know, fact, well, yeah, this is my Father, but it's the most intimate saying, yes, this is the one who I have a Father-Son relationship with. You see the difference between those. We can identify someone just simply in their place in order as Father and Son, but the term Abba refers to the relationship that exists between those two people. So it is a much more intense and meaningful term than just simply Father. Some people today have even suggested that what it really means is Daddy. You know, where someone would call him Daddy. I'm not sure. I'm not sure that I would carry it quite that far in that term. But it is. It does establish that personal relationship between those two. We try to understand. You know, Jesus's understanding of those terms. We also need to look at the relationship of God and Israel to understand that, okay? Because, and the reason I say that is because Jesus grew up as an Israelite, did he not? See? He grew up in the history and knowing the history of the Israelite people, and in particular the part that we're discussing this morning, he grew up knowing and learning about the relationship between God and the Israelite people. Okay? So that when we see Jesus in the temple, when he's 12 years old, Luke chapter 2, if you look over there, what we see there, the statement in verse 52, Jesus grew in wisdom and stature, in favor with God and man. That statement is made after he tells his parents, when they found him there in the temple, did you not know that I had to be about my Father's business? Okay? So the question then comes, how much did Jesus really know at that particular point about his relationship with the Father? See, did he make that statement based on the Israelite understanding of God as his Father? You see, and God as the Father of all the Israelites? Or did he understand it in terms of his peculiar, specific relationship as the Son of God? See? It's quite possible that his statement just simply reflects his understanding of that relationship that God had with the Israelite people as a father to them and they as children to him. We understand, and go back over to Luke chapter 24, where I told you we were going to look for just a moment there. This understanding and looking at the Old Testament scriptures here to really kind of get a more of a grasp and understanding on this relationship aspect. When Jesus was walking with the disciples that were on the road to Emmaus, okay, and they are discussing, you know, the events that have just taken place and so forth, and the two disciples, they're kind of confused, they're in bewilderment over what has happened, and they're expressing these things to Jesus, are they not? Even to the point where they, you know, made an expression saying, we had hope that he would be, you know, the one that was going to save us and so forth. They really did not understand what was going on anymore with Jesus. They had these great hopes and expectations, but then Jesus had been crucified and buried in the tomb, and now what's going to happen? And Jesus begins to explain to them and tell them about all of these events, and where does he explain these things to them from? From the Old Testament scriptures, you see. And look at verse 32. The disciples then say, after Jesus is, you know, taken from them, were not our hearts burning within us as he talked with us on the road and did what? Opened the scriptures to us. Which scriptures did he open to them? Old Testament, New Testament, but it didn't exist yet, did it? You see? So Jesus opened these Old Testament scriptures to them to help them to understand what was taking place more than anything concerning him. Okay? So we go back and we look at those Old Testament scriptures to see some more about this relationship between the Father and the Son. So let's look for just a minute at the ideas and the concepts in the Old Testament about God as a Father and Israel as a Son. Remember, keep in mind, these are the scriptures that Jesus grew up with. Well, these are the things that he would have learned and studied growing up. These are the concepts where they would have come from, okay? So we look at the whole range of material in the Hebrew Bible relating to fathers and sons here. That's where we've got to take a look at. When Jesus comes along and he's talking about this father-son relationship, that was not a new concept to the Israelites that were hearing it. Jesus was not bringing a new teaching to the ears of the Israelite people on that. There were a lot of other things he brought that were new, strange to them, but that was not one of them. Okay? They were very familiar with the imagery of God as Father and they themselves as his children. The imagery of fatherhood and sonship really finds its roots in the human experience of family life. Okay? If you go back and you look at the history of humanity, but in particular, for our purpose this morning, our study this morning, the Israelite people, the stability of the family was vitally important throughout man's history. It really has been. In fact, you can go back and trace historically, look at societies as they have come and gone, and one of the most important factors, okay, that has contributed throughout history to the demise of various cultures is the destruction or the falling apart of the family unit. Okay? Put another way, and people have expressed it in this kind of a way, as the family goes, so goes the church. As the family goes, so goes the country. If you go back and you look at you know, look at the way things are today. We've got all these different problems going on. And, you know, again, one of the biggest problems we have is with all of these killings that are going on and, you know, and so forth. What's happening? Why is it? Is it because we've got, you know, billions of guns all over the country? No, it's because our family structure is deteriorating and has been for several generations. And when the family structure begins to deteriorate, then you lose the senses of morality and conviction on certain things and so forth, and that's what's happening. And that's throughout history, that is what has happened. So the point here is that the structure of a family is vitally important, you see, to that family's growth and success, and it has been throughout history, and the Israelites are no different than that. Thus, we find one of the perhaps very familiar terms to most of us that we refer to three distinct parts or stages or phases of Bible history. The very first one is referred to as what? The patriarchal age, which means what? The fathers. It's the age of the fathers. Why is that so important? Because during that particular time, you see, the fathers were the head of their family. And everybody understood that, and everybody worked within that those parameters. And what that meant as the father being the head of the family was that that included as long as whoever the oldest male in that family line was, he was the patriarch, and he was in charge of his family concerning everything. Okay? Even his adult children, his adult sons, and their families and all of their possessions, the Israelite father was the head or ruler concerning everything domestic, concerning everything judicial, concerning everything educational, spiritual, even military authority over his entire family. See. And when you begin, again, look at and piece together and start, you know, understanding how all of these different Old Testament teachings come together, then it makes a whole lot more sense. We understand then the importance of the birthright and the blessing that the Old Testament speaks about. For who? The eldest or the firstborn son of the family. He received the birthright and the blessing. What were those two things all about? The birthright was about what?
Was it property?
Well, no, actually, that was that was who's going to be in charge. Okay, he received the birthright. He was the firstborn son. He's the next in line when his father dies to be the patriarch of that family. Okay, which then brought on the blessing, which was what? A double portion of the inheritance. Why did he need that? Because he's got a huge responsibility and family to take care of, you see. He's responsible for the whole family. So therefore, he got a double portion of the inheritance. Okay? Which again, you see, it goes back and shows us the provision that God had made amongst the people, his followers, you see, for this existence of this kind of a structure within the family. The significance of the role of the father in doing what? Providing for and protecting his family. See? And the Israelites understood that. And Jesus grew up with that kind of a teaching and understanding himself. And so there is a certain natural imagery that is applied into the relationship between God and Israel. Look over in Exodus chapter 4. When God is calling Moses to go and to free the Israelites from their bondage in Egypt. Verse 22 of chapter 4. Can I get somebody to read that for me, please? Keep going.
So I say to you, let my son go, that he may serve me. But if you refuse to let him go, indeed I will kill your son, your firstborn.
Okay. God is instructing Moses. Okay. And what is the reference that he makes to Israel? How does he refer to Israel here? As my firstborn son. And this is, as far as I can tell, this is the very first statement of such in the Scriptures. It's chapter 4, Exodus 4, verse 22, if I have that right. Okay? Up until this time, okay, look at the kinds of statements that God made concerning this same group of people. In chapter 3, verses 7 and verse 10, they are referred to simply as my people. Okay? Which is, how different is that kind of a statement from my son? Well, but he's still talking about the Israelite people here. But in the previous verses, in 7 and 10 of chapter 3, he's just referring to the Israelite people as my people. But then as he's talking to Moses and giving him the instructions to go to Pharaoh, he refers to this same group of people, Israel, as my firstborn son. Yeah, it is a much more intimate reference here in that. In chapter 3 and verse 15, at that particular point, God was known by the Israelite people mainly as the God of their fathers. Okay? Again, not God our Father, but the God of our fathers, you see? In other words, basically referencing the patriarchs that have gone before them, that they recognize that He was their God. You see? But now, from this point on, what we see is this relationship that God expresses first to Moses, and Moses declares that to Pharaoh, Israel is my son. They're not just my people, and I'm just not the God of their fathers. I am their father, and they are my son. They... a very significant change in that descriptive there. In Deuteronomy chapter 1 and verse 31, there God declares to the Israelite people, there you saw how the Lord your God carried you as a father carries his son all the way you went until you reached this place. Well, what's he talking about? He's talking about how he brought them out of Egypt and to the promised land. Okay? And his description of that process was that he carried them just like a father carries his son. Right? So God is making known to the Israelite people how he sees the relationship that he has with them. Okay? Deuteronomy chapter 32, verses 18 through 20, in the song of Moses there, it shows the relationship, and it also talks about the discipline aspect of that very relationship. And so, again, we see those kinds of expressions. A father and a son and so forth. In the Hebrew language, the word or the letters ab, the part of the word ab, which is the father part, they used that in many of their names. Okay? As they named their children. Go through the genealogies and go through and look at how many people have those that part of their name, like Joab and Abijah and Eliab. See, the significance of that is that that means God is Father. That's what it means. So we need to understand that it meant that to a father who was naming his son, and he attaches to the name of his son, God is Father, and that meant perhaps not only personally, God is our personal Father, but He's also the Father of us as a people, as a tribe, or as a nation. They clearly were identifying themselves as the children of God. See? We are out of time, and I got more to go here. But that's all right. We're going to stop right here. All right? And we'll pick up with this next week. Never have enough time in here. All right. Okay. Thank you all very much.